Small business owners are always passionate about their work, and they have a lot on the line. Let Verizon help champion your small business dream. Whether you own a small business or scaling one or starting one from scratch, you need Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon Business Experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon Business Expert. Plus, Verizon Business Experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon has your back. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/small business.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
And tonight on the CNBC Special Hour, the world on edge as a growing energy crisis in Europe shakes global markets, with Russia launching another salvo in its growing energy fight with the West. Stocks fall again as oil stays high and OPEC actually cuts production tonight. We are drilling down on the moves of the day, what it means for your money and for America ahead. You're going to hear from some of the biggest players in the business, including the CEOs of America's largest natural gas producer, EQT, as well as the CEO of utility AEP on how to make sure that your electric grid will hold up for years to come. Plus, energy analyst Rusty Brazil on America's role in helping Europe, and OPEC global oil expert Halima Croft on what the group is thinking right now. All right, welcome everybody to this CNBC special energy emergency. I am Brian Sullivan. Jim is off tonight and all week. Thank you very much for joining us. Well, if you think that Europe's energy crisis could not get more chaotic or maybe even more confusing, there's a lot going on. Think again. There have been a flurry of headlines and new comments in just the last 48 hours that add even more layers to that story. First, Putin launching another salvo in his energy war with Europe. He is cutting off all natural gas flows from the Nord Stream pipeline from Russia into Germany until the Western sanctions on his oil end. Keep in mind, there is not only no timeline for those sanctions to end, but more stringent sanctions on Russian oil are set to go in force on December 5th. European spot natural gas prices, they've come down a little bit in the last couple of days, but they're up more than 1,600% over just 2 years. And electricity prices across much of Europe are at record highs, in some cases 10 times what we are paying here in America. Headline number two, OPEC and Russia agreeing to effectively cut oil production by 100,000 barrels a day beginning next month. This is something that we reported may happen just over a week ago here on CNBC. OPEC saying they are worried about global demand slowing down in the months ahead. And story three, and this is a big one, it's not getting a lot of attention, but it should. Could the energy crisis turn into a financial or even a banking problem? Listen to this. An executive at Equinor, the massive Norwegian energy company formerly known as Statoil, one of the biggest in the world, saying as much as $1.5 trillion worth of margin calls over energy trading could require some kind of backstop or maybe even bailout, or energy trading itself may be at risk globally. By the way, that $1.5 trillion would be on top of what Goldman Sachs says could be an additional $2 trillion in higher energy bills this winter for European families. All this, the new prime minister of the UK says, they may have to spend about $200 billion to help cover energy bills for their growing nervous population and their industry. So let's try to figure out how this all plays out. Joining us now is somebody who puts it together better than anybody. And that is Halima Croft, Global Head of Commodity Strategy at RBC Capital Markets and a CNBC contributor. Halima, we tried to touch on just a little bit of what's going on there. We could probably do the whole show on just laying out the events of the last couple of weeks. From where you see it, and your research is must read on Wall Street, where do we stand right now?
I mean, I think we're in this situation with Russia right now where we just don't know how far they're going to go in terms of weaponizing energy. They've basically said, as you said, no gas through Nord Stream 1. Are they going to cut off Turk Stream? Are they going to basically suspend all gas through Ukraine? Are they going to take Europe to zero? And the Europeans have been very clear. They've built storage, they're building out infrastructure. But if we get a very cold winter in Europe, I don't see how we're not going to get through this without major industrial curtailments, rationing. It's going to be very, very expensive in terms of what governments are going to have to pay to keep their populations at all satisfied with energy prices.
And this is an incredibly important point that you're making. And I want to highlight for our audience that is sort of maybe following the story. They know a little bit about it, but they don't really understand where we stand. They hear that, okay, German storage is at 85%, and right, that is good news. But here's the issue. Germany has never existed through a winter on storage alone. They tend to draw their storage down, do they not, even with additional flows?
Absolutely. And again, they've gotten to 85% because Russian gas was flowing up till, you know, a couple months ago. Brian, this is, may not be a crisis just for this winter. This could be a multi-winter crisis, because if there is no gas going forward, Europe is going to have a huge supply problem going forward, even with this infrastructure buildup, because again, there's not a lot of additional gas in the system. I was just in Norway. The Norwegians have really raised their oil and gas production by close to 10%, but they are saying we're number one supplier to Europe for now, but we don't know how much more we can do. We're pretty much tapped out. So that is a real challenge, is there's just not a lot of additional gas volumes out there.
Well, thankfully, the United States has been selling liquefied natural gas. And by the way, the Chinese have probably been reselling some, have they not? I mean, we sell it from Texas. The Chinese take ownership of it. The ship gets halfway across the Pacific. And then somebody in the UK and Europe buys it back from the Chinese at some hugely elevated rate because they need the liquefied natural gas. If the Chinese, for some reason, start to get aggressive in buying that gas again and not reselling it, or it gets really cold in China, again, where they need the energy, or they stop the COVID lockdowns, what then?
So, Brian, I mean, this is the big conundrum, is if we have a cold winter, not only in Europe, but in Asia, and they bid away these volumes. I mean, as you know, think about Qatar, huge natural gas supplier. Their volumes are largely under long-term contract to Asia. If you have Asia actually entering the spot market and competing with Europe for volumes, that is only going to make it that much more challenging for Europe to get through winter.
Okay, OPEC. Let's talk OPEC. Yes. Because Monday, it was Labor Day here, so they had their meeting. We weren't, I knew you were probably listening in. I was doing the best I could. They effectively cut production by rolling back their quota by 100,000 that they had added a couple of months earlier after the president, President Biden, went there. What is OPEC trying to do? What do you think their end goal? Is this just to sort of embarrass, do you think, the United States, or do they have a real demand fear scenario that they are confronting?
I mean, I think OPEC is back into active market management. I think what they want to do is to signal they're not in cruise control. I mean, this was kind of a micro move. This was not a major move from a physical market standpoint. But what I think is interesting is when you read the statement, they basically said, we don't have to wait 30 days. We can come into this market very quickly to take additional action as needed. So if you're thinking about shorting oil and you have a major move lower or a major event like Iran coming back out of the market, which I still think is going to be very challenging, OPEC is basically ready to go back in quickly and adjust production.
Halima Croft, RBC Capital Markets, as we said, laying it out like nobody else can. We really appreciate it, Halima. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, as we mentioned, you're very welcome. As we mentioned at the top of the hour, the moves in energy playing a role in the macro markets and your money recently. Russia's oil and gas battle with Europe casting a shadow across the EU and really around the world. The Dow, the S&P 500, and NASDAQ all ended the day lower. And this is random but painful. The NASDAQ is now down seven sessions in a row. That is its longest losing streak in 6 years. It wasn't just tech. Occidental Petroleum, the hottest oil and gas stock so far this year, down nearly 3% today, still up 158% of the year. The XLE, big energy ETF, lost about 1%, still doing well. The XOP, kind of a similar story, down today. But one of the few bright spots in the entire stock market this year has been certainly oil and gas. All right, so that also remains a bright spot, as we noted over the past year. So oil and gas, they've done well for investors. But overall, it's been one of the worst years for the stock market in, well, decades. And the energy crisis in Europe is one big part. Not the only part, but a big part of the reason. So let's stay right there and expand it out a little bit. Because one reason that Russia shut down that entire Nord Stream gas flow to Germany is that it wants those Western sanctions removed on its oil. But as we noted at the top, that is not going to happen. And in fact, the full European sanctions on Russian energy do not kick in until December 5th, when the West tries to stop nearly all flows of Russian oil by hitting the financing and insurance and shipping side of the business, making it nearly impossible to sell a shipload of Putin's crude. And Russia has said, if that happens, it will retaliate. Now, some of that may have just been what we witnessed. But today, Russia did something else that was odd and disturbing. They released a video apparently showing a freezing Europe. Let's bring in Dan Juergen, Vice Chairman of S&P Global, and Andy Lipow, President of Lipow Oil Associates. Dan, I don't know if you had a chance to see this sort of bizarre commercial. Okay, we're not going to give Putin any airtime for his sort of disgusting promotion, but we'll show a tiny clip to our audience where the gas flow goes to zero, weird music, icy winds, what looks to be ice across London and other parts of Germany. Dan, what the heck kind of message is Putin trying to send here?
I think the message is very clear, Brian, which is that this is an energy war, that this is the energy front in the war in Ukraine. And Putin laid out his strategy in June. He gave a speech in which he said high prices will create economic hardship, social turmoil, bring populists to power, and strangely used this phrase, almost as creepy as that that video, which is change the elites in Europe. And what he left unsaid is destroy, undermine, make it impossible for the coalition to hold together supporting Ukraine. And now we're down to, you know, what we've just seen is basically an escalation in the energy war. And it's clearly the Russians have had plenty of time to figure this out. This is a direct response to the sanctions, but to the notion of the price cap being put on. So this is an escalation. And I'll just tell you, we've had the German economic minister, now the Finnish economics minister, warning of, strangely enough, a Lehman-style economic collapse. So this is escalation. And that video is really creepy.
It is. And we just wanted to give a little clip of it because we didn't give it too much airtime, but we wanted to give the audience an idea of what kind of almost psychological warfare that they're doing. You know, Andy, I mean, here's the thing. And again, we've been covering this story. I've been over there a couple of times on this, and I get it. People say you're fear-mongering. Germany's going to be fine. They've been through worse. They will be fine long-term. We understand that. Europe has been through a lot more difficult situations, actual wars, than this. That said, trillions of dollars are at risk. Entire industries and economies, Andy, are they not? Fertilizers, aluminum, zinc, things we never think about until we have to.
Well, it certainly is when you think about all the energy intensive industries, starting with the metals, whether it's aluminum, steel, zinc, or other industries such as cement and glasses, you can see everything is going to be affected, including the entire automobile industry, which depends on aluminum parts. You can think about in France, wine bottles and wine glasses are going to be difficult to source as glass factories shut down. So there's a lot of things that are happening, and Russia is looking to put Europe really into a recession. What I might add is this is going to affect China in a big way, given the immense amount of trade that's going on between China and Europe. So this can come back to hurt China as well.
Yeah, and Dan, you literally, I would say, wrote the book, but you've actually written numerous books. Of course, the prize, your first one, and the new map, which was, by the way, is just required reading for everybody. You've got to read that. So you see this thing sort of from almost an outer space point of view where you put the globe together. It feels like Russia, China, Iran, and to a lesser extent, India, are kind of forming their own odd coalition versus the West. How does this reshape geopolitics?
Well, I think that we're seeing geopolitics being reshaped in real time right now, because basically Russia's integration with the West is over. The door has been slammed. Putin has thrown away 22 years of economic integration, and basically Russia ends up an economic dependency of China. Obviously, Iran, you know, they're comparing notes on how do you deal with sanctions, and Russia's buying drones right now from Iran to. I think India is sort of more in a middle situation. The Indian foreign minister said, you know, basically said, we don't have a dog in this hunt. We're interested in food, fuel, and fertilizer, what Andy was referring to. But I think India is in a quandary because it's also in this thing called the Quad with the United States trying to contain China, which is its rival. But on the other hand, it has a historic relationship. Yeah. And by the way, it loves buying cheap oil from Russia
now. That's it. You know, Andy, I watched an interview, a CNBC interview with our colleague Hadley Gamble with Hardeep Singh, who's the energy minister. And he tried to explain it away and say, well, we've got 1.4 billion people. We got to think about them. We're democratically elected. And he is right. But you do have a dog in the hunt. If you're going to buy cheap oil from Vladimir Putin when almost the rest of the industrialized world has said they are not going to. Don't India, do they have, in your mind, a responsibility to the world, to Ukraine?
Well, I think that India doesn't feel that way. They're looking out for their own economic self-interest, and they're benefiting from the deeply discounted Russian oil that they're purchasing. As Daniel mentioned, I mean, India is really trying to contain China. At the same time, they're maintaining relations with Russia and the West. So from their standpoint, they may think of themselves as neutral, just taking advantage of the situation. Yeah. But ultimately, they are going to be affected as well. If Europe goes into a recession, you know, India needs to export a lot of consumer goods and services.
You know, Dan, I want to ask you a final question, because here's the thing in the interview that I found a little bit vexing. And I didn't find it vexing. I understood what he was doing. He basically said, well, the sanctions aren't working anyway, so we should buy them. But maybe the sanctions aren't working because India keeps buying now so much Russian oil. And it's not just them, obviously. It's others as well. And a lot of it is getting to Europe, right? I mean, just they're transferring the ship or they're claiming different ownership of it. Are the current sanctions working on Russia?
Well, the current sanctions right now, I mean, there are a lot of sanctions, but oil exports are not sanctioned. And one reason the U.S. government has come up with this idea of a price cap is a way to keep the oil flowing to India, because they don't want to have a 7 million barrel a day hole in the market. So it's really a tough situation. And there's India, which imports 85% of its oil that, you know, they need to get it from. So no, what at least Washington is trying to do is prevent there being a worse crisis. But it's, you know, it's a really tough situation come, as you said, December 5th, when the ban goes into effect, including on insurance and shipping. Then it gets a lot more difficult.
Yeah, and we'll listen, there's been people calling, Dan, I'm sure you've heard it. They're saying maybe we don't need to do the sanctions because the population, some right winger in Italy said that today. We'll find out. Dan Juergen and Andy Lipow, a good discussion, guys. We could have done the whole hour. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, this CNBC special, Energy Emergency, is just getting started. Stay with us.
Tonight, don't keep it on the QT. Is liquid gold offshore and ready for the taking? Plus, don't get rusty. Stay on top of your energy game with RBN's analysis. And unlimited power? We go off the grid with the CEO of AEP when we return on CNBC.
Fact. Running a business is not getting easier on your wallet. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. Also a fact, smart businesses are reducing costs and headaches by graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. See how you'll profit with NetSuite, and then you can think of all the ways you could be spending the money you save. Company retreat in Malibu, anyone? By popular demand, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com to start saving.
When you're hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging to connect with candidates faster. Plus, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mad Money. Just go to Indeed.com/Mad Money right now and support this show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mad Money. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, welcome back to the CNBC special energy emergency. Now, last Monday, New England was issued a bit of a warning. The operator of New England's power grid warned that the region may be at risk of not having adequate power going forward unless regulators and policymakers accept the reality of needing natural gas in the near and perhaps even longer term. In a draft document ahead of an important forum later on this week, the grid operator, known as ISO New England, said, quote, "For the clean energy transition to be successful, the region must continue to have reliable supplies of gas for home heating and electricity." Then they add this, quote, "The current lack of a regional plan to ensure energy adequacy, including the absence of state or federal regulatory solution, endangers the reliability of the electric power system." That's quite a warning. And they even referred to what is happening in Germany as a reason to maybe make sure that we don't make the same mistakes by not having enough power. And that warning is not all New Englanders are facing. Wholesale electricity prices more than doubled in July from a year ago. Energy inflation continues to hit families across the region. And what's amazing is that all this is happening in an area that is 150 or so miles from the biggest natural gas field in America, which is not in Texas. It is the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania and New York. EQT is the biggest natural gas producer in America. Toby Rice is the CEO, and he joins us now. Toby, I'm sure you saw that document. On one hand, were you heartened by the fact that you've got the grid operator basically saying to regulators and state governors and whatever, hey, we're going to need some gas for years to come, and for goodness sakes, don't shut down the only liquefied natural gas import terminal we have? Or were you disheartened by the fact that they continue to basically say, well, the pipelines are full and we'll make the transition, and there's not much we can do in the long term?
Well, you know, I think ultimately reality is going to catch up, and you're going to see this translate to policies that will ultimately hopefully bring energy security to the citizens in the United States. You know, the move to renewables and clean energy and that transition and how bringing energy security, I think you can look at Europe and how that's played out. They really leaned into you know, clean solar and wind. And they find themselves in probably one of the worst lurches in the world right now. So that is not the answer. The answer is very simple. It's let's take advantage of proven fuels that can provide energy security. And that is hydrocarbons, specifically natural gas, to generate cheap, clean, reliable power. And what's amazing in Boston, they have got the easiest opportunity. They don't need to be sourcing their gas from halfway around the world like what Europe has to do. They can source gas literally from their next door neighbors here in Pennsylvania, home of the biggest gas field in the world, the Marcellus Shale, currently producing over 35 BCF a day. That's over a third of the total U.S. gas production comes from states a couple hundred miles away. It'd be very simple for us to put some more of those gas, some more of those pipelines over to get them hooked up. It's a very obvious solution.
Well, and here's what. You know, there's going to be a lot of pushback on the pipelines. And I mean, that's if anybody can get that done, it'll be some sort of New England political miracle, Toby. I mean, but I do remember, I think it was earlier this year or late last year, that the situation got a little bit dire enough that this Everett, Massachusetts, sort of near Boston, liquefied natural gas terminal, they had to bring in a shipment of LNG from Trinidad. And nobody's knocking on Trinidad, but the concept that you're importing a shipload of LNG when, to your point, you've got this field, an American field, very close nearby, just seems ludicrous.
It's certainly bizarre. I mean,
and dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, here's the reality. You know, we're shipping, we're the world's largest exporter of LNG. And as our LNG tankers are leaving the United States to head to Europe, they are passing LNG tankers coming from other parts of the country. And we're waving as we cross each other. It's absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, the other thing that's kind of ridiculous is, you know, the fact that the New England is relying on heating oil for a large portion of their heating, and in dire times, they turn to use that for electricity and power gen. And let's not forget, last winter, they were saved by oil, and that about 30% of their electricity stack was generated with oil. And we've got the biggest natural gas resource right next door. And what's remarkable is we built over 2 million miles of pipelines in this country, and we've never seemed to have an issue up until about 5 years ago, when all of a sudden pipeline infrastructure started getting canceled, blocked, and opposed. And unfortunately, New England is going to bear the brunt of this. Right now, natural gas prices are elevated, but if you look forward into the future, natural gas prices in New England are scheduled to be over $40 this winter. We're going to be selling that same gas here in Appalachia for a price of $8. It's pretty remarkable.
Why
happening.
The spread? Why the $32 spread? Because you know what they're going to say, Toby? You're a rich guy. You guys have share buybacks. They're going to come after you and your company and others in America and say, well, you're making all this money. You should be adding capacity. But you can't, because you can't pipe it anywhere, correct? You have nowhere to put it.
We're out of pipeline infrastructure. You know, Sully, you can't push a rope uphill. You can't put more gas in a pipeline that's already full. So if you want to alleviate this bottleneck, and that is a major opportunity for pipeline infrastructure, we would love to build these pipelines and connect this market with cheap, reliable, clean energy, natural gas that's produced here in America. We just need more pipeline infrastructure to do it. But it's been blocked. Over 7 BCF a day of pipelines have been blocked, canceled, and closed that would take gas from the largest gas field in the world to other parts of the United States.
And to your point, you got thousands, tens of hundreds of thousands of people using heating oil. And on any given day, a certain part of the New England power grid makeup, literally, Toby, will be dung and landfill gas. It's publicly available. You can look it up. Toby Rice, EQT CEO. Toby, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Dung. All right, on deck in this special hour, the Department of Energy recently, rather quietly, but also kind of loudly, sent a warning to some big American oil and gas producers. Make sure we have enough before you sell any overseas, or else. That's next.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX. Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, welcome back to this special CNBC Hour. We are blessed and lucky to live in the United States. We have plenty of energy, so much so that we can sell a lot of it around the world, and we are. So far this year, the U.S. has exported more liquefied natural gas to Europe than in all of last year. U.S. crude oil exports, they reached a record 5 million barrels a day in August, mostly to Europe. Remember, we used to be a net importer of oil. Now, those cargoes are helping Europeans blunt the impact of Putin's aggression. But in late August, the U.S. Department of Energy sent a letter to some big oil and gas CEOs with a bit of a warning. prioritize building U.S. inventories now or risk unspecified federal emergency actions. Let's talk more about this and the export market and dig deeper with RBN Energy CEO Rusty Brazil, well known to the Mad Money and Jim Cramer family. Rusty, it's good to have you on. I'll try to do my best to make up where Jim left off. And I mean, we talk about the stocks, the Tellurians, the Cheniers, which is ticker LNG, Semper Energies of the world. But how critical is U.S. liquefied natural gas to blunting everything we're talking about Putin doing in Europe?
Absolutely critical, Brian. We are, as you said, exporting a lot of LNG right now. Just last week, we put 18 cargoes on the water. At least 10 of those went to Europe, probably another 4 went to Europe. And we would be exporting more if we hadn't have lost one of the LNG export facilities, Freeport, about 3 months ago. And that already has cut about 50 cargoes out of the market.
By the way, do we still know really what happened at Freeport?
Well, we know that there was a fire. It was a fire in the wrong place, and therefore the unit was down. But in terms of the details, I really don't know the specific details of the damage.
Yeah, I mean, in that Freeport, that LNG, Freeport's a private company here, you know, right. And it's a huge company. Do you feel like there could be a risk to U.S. energy, LNG, and or oil exports? I mean, the Department of Energy, and I understand what they're doing. They're basically saying, hey, make sure we in America have enough of our own energy in winter before we ship it around the world. I can see their point of view.
Absolutely. But obviously, we are exporting a lot of energy right now. And if we weren't exporting that energy, what would be happening in the international markets today? Crude oil prices would be back to the $120. Natural gas prices would be off the scale. So effectively, because we are operating in a global marketplace, it's a necessity that we continue to export the way we are right now. In terms of how that's going to play out with what the administration has said, you don't know. But my guess is that not much different is going to happen by the time we get into the winter season.
Okay. You know, there's this, and I'm rubbing my eyes, Rusty, because I'm tired of the political fight. This shouldn't be a political issue, but everything's political now, where you get one side saying one thing and the other side saying the other. And I understand why tens of millions of Americans are caught in the middle, think, I don't understand the energy business. I don't have any idea who's right, who's telling me the truth, or sort of, let's say, playing a little bit fast and loose. Can you explain to our audience, in plain Texan English, whatever that is, what the difference between a lease and a permit is? Because all we hear is, oh, there's all these leases and no one's doing anything. And then the industry says, well, I got leases, but I can't permit it, so I can't build. What's the difference?
Well, I'm going to get to your specific question in a second, but in my opinion, this is not nearly as big a deal as it's being made by either side. So a lease means that I own a right in order to produce hydrocarbons off of a particular plot of land, effectively the resources that are underneath a particular plot of land. I have to have that lease in order to be able to produce those hydrocarbons, and I'm probably leasing that from a farmer or from the descendant of somebody who owned that property years and years ago. But I cannot drill the well until I have a permit to drill the well. So the permit is the permit to drill and complete. The lease gives me the right to the hydrocarbons under the ground.
So is there anybody that's right, or are they both kind of telling the truth?
I think they're both kind of telling the truth. The reality is there's a lot of things that are keeping production in the United States, basically keeping a cap on production in the United States. And that's issues like I can't hire enough people. I've got supply chain issues on equipment. I've got capital restraint that public company, the Wall Street, wants me to pay dividends rather than drill more wells. So all of those things are contributing, and we've got this lease and permit issue that's just added up on top of it.
It's rhetoric, political rhetoric at its finest on both sides, by the way. I tip my cap. Rusty Brazil, I tip my cap to you. Thank you very much, Rusty.
All right, thanks, Brian.
All right, don't go anywhere. The CNBC special energy emergency will continue right after this short break.
Coming up, look out for the pick of the litter. Make your energy stock picks work for you. Plus, do the electric slide? A key utility player joins us. And go clean and earn green? Alternative solutions to an energy emergency. When we return on CNBC.
All right, welcome back. Let's talk about this terrible and record-breaking heat happening in California and other parts of the West. Air conditioners, they are cranking 24-7. State asking people to conserve as much as possible and to do things like not charge their electric cars to save power. All this has pushed the power grid out west to its limit. The California grid operator saying this afternoon they could see the highest demand the state has ever seen. And it is not just California. Heat in the Midwest also causing power issues this summer. So how do you make sure that if you need the air conditioning to stay on for safety or the heat to come on in winter for safety, it will? Let's drill down on the future of our power grid with Nick Akins. He is the chairman and CEO of American Electric Power, one of the biggest power generators in the United States, if not the world. Nick, thank you for coming on the program. In the Biden bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, there's been a lot of money for clean energy, for climate, and a big part of that, as I understand it, is for infrastructure improvements. Part of the reason we have fires and power outages are 75-year-old power lines. What will that money mean for AEP and to make sure we have a reliable grid?
It'll mean a lot for the entire grid. Not only the fundamental bill that was done earlier relative to infrastructure, but also the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act legislation. Both of those go together really to focus on not only resiliency of the grid, but also movement to that clean energy economy. So if we do it in a mindful way, we're mitigating the prices for customers in these periods, because with renewables, you can certainly hedge natural gas prices and those kinds of things that are rising in cost. But also with the infrastructure side, we can be mindful of how we're moving toward and what pace we're moving toward that clean energy economy. And that means making sure we have baseload generation and the resiliency in place, whether it's nuclear, whether it's even natural gas and coal. So we need to focus on those things as a balanced portfolio going forward during this time.
And what lessons, if any, because there are different regulatory schemes, but Nick, what lessons can you and the other power companies in America learn from what's happening in the UK and Europe?
Oh, absolutely. It's around making sure we're using options and looking at that option value associated with different types of resources in play. You can't do everything with one single type of resource, and you can't have a single point of vulnerability on the grid or in terms of resources. So we have to ensure that we're building in resiliency, building in multiple resources that are available, different kinds of resources, because each one of them present both pros and cons. And doing that can help us mitigate any impacts relative to not only pricing, but also resiliency associated with the grid.
We're going to talk about renewables and nuclear in the next segment of the show. But before we talk about the equities, Nick, I want to ask you about running a plant. You own one, a Donald C. Cook plant in sort of southwestern Michigan. If you decided, you and your board decided tomorrow, we're going to build a new nuclear plant, could you get it done? And how long would it take?
Well, I think that's a tremendous challenge. When you're trying to build a nuclear station that size and how much capital is being deployed to associate with the construction and the construction time period, you're talking about 15 years to do something like that with a lot of risk on construction and cost during the interim. So our corporation would not make that bet. What we will do, and certainly the Inflation Reduction Act presents particular value associated with small modular reactors. The small modular reactors provide a smaller benefit, smaller capital, but also the ability to transition from fossil generation to more 24/7 type of generation. So yeah, that option's available. We just have to take the time to make sure it's done right.
Yeah, I got to do something more on the SMRs, the small modular reactors. That is a very interesting technology, but that's for another day. Nick Akins, thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us, CEO of AEP. All right, coming up, we are going to put that fossil right back in the ground, and we're going to talk about the renewables opportunity and why no one, well, almost no one, is talking about nuclear, because we will next. All right, welcome back. Here's something that you might have missed last week. It didn't exactly get a lot of attention. California did a major U-turn and said that it will keep its last nuclear plant running, Diablo Canyon, for at least another 5 years. Now, you may not know this, but about one-fifth of electricity on any given day in the U.S. comes from nuclear power plants. That's as much as all other clean energy sources combined, and yet everybody seems to be talking about shutting down nuclear. Joining us now at the Deeper Dive on Nuclear and Other Clean Energy and Renewables, Stephen Fleischman. He is Senior Analyst at Wolf Research. And Stephen, I know you're focused more on sort of extending nuclear. Just heard the AEP CEO say in a very, you know, CEO way, we would not touch building another plant.
Yeah.
Germany is, that's what he said. Germany is now talking about extension. Who would be the winners if we finally kind of got a clue about fusion?
Yeah, so look, the first, thanks, Brian, for having me. The winner, there's one real winner on existing nuclear, well more than anyone else, and that's Constellation Energy. CEG is the ticker. They're the largest owner of nuclear in the U.S. They're the best, one of the best operators. And all of their nuclear is unregulated, and it benefits from not only high gas prices that we're seeing and tight power markets, but also the new IRA bill that passed that has special treatment for existing nuclear plants.
When we talk about so-called clean energy, and you can get into the argument about, is it clean because the turbines don't biodegrade or you got to dig up lithium from Australia? Forget about all that. When we talk about, quote, clean energy, do you include nuclear in that? Should be,
yeah,
right? It's zero emission.
We think nuclear is definitely part of the clean energy transition, and it's really critical because most renewables are, or all renewables are intermittent. They don't run all the time, and they tend to run at the same time. So when they're not running, you need to make sure you've got other forms of power running and the core baseload power that we've had, and we're shutting coal to reduce carbon. We're not adding that much gas anymore. So nuclear is really critical as the baseload fuel that runs 95% of the time and is also carbon free. So it's a really critical piece, particularly if we want to keep shutting more coal.
Yeah. Okay. Hydrogen. I've got people that will tell me, Stephen, this is the future. Blue, green, gray hydrogen, clean, dirty, whatever. Hydrogen is the answer. I got other people that are, I respect just as much, to say hydrogen is terrible. It has no future. It's too doggone expensive. It's too dangerous, whatever. Who's right?
Yeah, the former is right. Hydrogen is now, and green, clean hydrogen is now the most economic form of hydrogen with this new IRA law that passed with significant tax credits for green hydrogen. And so it's going to be part of the mix. It's a way to store energy, and it's a way to accelerate decarbonization. It won't just be renewables, though, that make green hydrogen. The amazing thing is that nuclear will also be part of making green hydrogen. So that's going to be the other story you're going to hear on nuclear, is it's going to be a play on producing hydrogen, too.
Yeah, and then you got the winners like a Plug Power, Bloom Energy, some names you like with those?
Yeah, Plug's been our favorite way to play the hydrogen story. They've got a lot of different irons in the fire, not just in the U.S., but also in Europe and Asia. Europe obviously having a tremendous energy crisis where hydrogen just is economic. Yeah. Green hydrogen's economic today. So Plug is the best way to play hydrogen story.
Stephen Fleischman, Wolf Research, looking at nuclear, looking at hydrogen. Really appreciate it. Got a little
great
breaking
thanks,
news
Brian.
For you, by the way. Hold there. We're going to get to the tease in a second, but I want to read this because we were just talking about grid systems. Well, the California ISO system just came out and basically said they're going to declare an emergency level 3 warning around 5:30 p.m. I assume that's Pacific time tonight, which means there could be rolling blackouts and brownouts throughout California. So California's grid operator just moments ago or minutes ago coming out and saying that be prepared from 4 to 9 p.m. tonight that we could have more demand than we can make power, and there could be rolling blackouts across California. Bad news, it's been 100 degrees. You need that air conditioning running. Unbelievable. All right. Coming up next, the good news on gas prices. They have crashed in the past few months, but can it last? Patrick DeHaan of Gas Buddy is up with that next. And stay tuned for the news with Shepard Smith beginning at 7 p.m. Eastern right here on CNBC. That's up in just 7 minutes. Stick around. All right, gasoline prices are still up sharply from this time last year, but Americans are finally seeing costs come down. In fact, they've crashed the last 2 months. But is OPEC's slash to October production and the strategic reserve having to be refilled going to put that in jeopardy? Let's talk about it. Joining us now is a man who follows it as closely as anybody, Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy. Hey, not going to say anything. Patrick, I just drove 1,000 miles across the upper Midwest the last 2 days. It was nice to see gas in the low threes. Is it going to last?
Well, Brian, I think outside of hurricane season, of course, that's the wild card here. That and refinery outages like we saw last week, BP's refinery in Indiana went down for a electrical fire. I think it will continue barring some of those outside factors. By the end of the year, I think prices nationally could be 25 to 50 cents lower than where they are today. Of course, you may not want to take that road trip in the colder months when the snow starts flying, but prices will be lower, I think, by the end of the year.
Wow, that is some good news. Now, we have been blessed with the weather. We did this on my show last week, Patrick. It's been only the third time in 70 years where we did not have a named hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico or Atlantic. So we just got blessed by Mother Nature in a different way outside of the California heat waves. How lucky have we been in the Gulf with no outages because of storms?
Well, Brian, I'd like to knock on wood, though there are a couple of named storms now and a couple areas of interest. I mean, it's certainly very uncharacteristic of hurricane season to not see a named storm in August, but that also doesn't guarantee that Mother Nature is going to cooperate for September. And in the predicament we're in, prices have gone down, but that doesn't mean the coast is clear. In fact, supplies remain relatively tight. Gasoline is okay, but diesel and distillates are the tight spot. If we still see any major hurricanes venturing into the Gulf of Mexico, that could shut down refineries long enough to cause gas prices and diesel to go back up before going back down towards the end of the year.
What about refilling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? It's at 40-year lows. We've been selling about 1 million barrels a day from it for months, and we do that all the way up through early November. There's a long-term chart we're showing our audience. I mean, this legally has to be refilled.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously, that's what is being mulled over by the administration. They have said that they're going to come up with a plan to allow the DOE to fill it with a different kind of refill plan than we've seen in years past and situations past. I would hope that the administration is going to be buying low. Certainly, they sold at the top of the market. But that's the biggest question. Does the SPR refill change the market from a bearish one in recent weeks to a bullish one? There certainly is that possibility. I think the administration is really going to have to nail it to be able to pull this off. Obviously, 180 million barrels of refill is a pretty steep order, especially now given that OPEC is starting to cut production.
Are we seeing $2 gas? I mean, not $2, but like $2.80 anywhere in America, $2.95. Do we have two handles somewhere?
We are. In fact, 18 states, no one's average is yet below that. So I want to make that distinction, but 18 states, yeah, have at least one station under that $3 gallon mark. Wow. Brian, in fact, I just checked this afternoon, two, yep, stations in Iowa, $2.59 a gallon for gasoline.
There you go. You go, Iowa. Thank you very much. Patrick DeHaan of Gas Buddy, appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
And that does it for us here. The news with Shepard Smith starts right now. Thanks for watching.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.